Now to those coccoliths and their friends. Why should you care? Well, their absence would take your breath away. I'm with Professor Gustav Hallegraaff in Hobart. Many people think that our oxygen comes mainly from forests. They are the lungs of our city, but in fact, the forests absorb almost as much oxygen as they give out. Where do our breaths come from?
So a lot of people in the street don't really know or respect the microscopic plankton algae of the world oceans. And in fact, every second breath of oxygen that we take comes from the microscopic algae in the oceans. The second breath of air comes from the higher plants on the land.
They exude oxygen and that just fills the atmosphere in general, does it?
That's right. And of course, these organisms were here way before the land plants. These organisms evolved already 3.5 billion years ago. And the land plants are relative newcomers. They only turned up about 400 million years ago. So a lot of the oxygen that actually accumulated in our atmosphere first came from the marine microscopic algae.
Now, these microscopic creatures, the algae, as you say, they come and go in vast populations. Some are okay and some are very harmful. I remember going over the mountains and I could see Jarvis Bay, which had gone the most incredible, I think, greenish colour, and it was almost glowing. And sometimes we have red blooms. These are not good.
Okay, yes, I am well familiar with that Jervis Bay algal blooms in 1999 or something. Basically, overnight, it colored Jervis Bay a milky green. The local people really had never seen anything, and initially they blamed effluents from the local milk factories. This, in fact, was a completely natural event. It's just a single-celled species that found itself in the right environmental conditions of temperature and nutrients. These organisms can divide sometimes 5 to 10 times per day. So you just need a week of favorable conditions and the whole bay turns milky white. So this particular organism, a coccolithophorid, was in fact a good species. So it does a lot of photosynthesis. So it takes carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, so it clears out the greenhouse gases, and in exchange it gives us land animals oxygen. So this was a good species. Now a week later that organism was gone and there really were no harmful effects of that particular organism. But yes, there are other algal species that can cause us harm. For listeners that lived in Sydney, were in Sydney in November last year, there were about 13 beaches, including the famous Bondi Beach. Suddenly, on a blue Monday, it just was colored like blood. And people looked at it in amazement. You know, where did that come from? What is it? So these are organisms that I've been working on for more than 40 years of my life. So that, again, was a relatively harmless species. The only harm it really did cause that people at that day in Sydney could not go in the water. If they would have done so, they would have probably developed maybe some skin rashes. The surfers liked it. They had their wetsuits on, and that organism was, in fact, bioluminescent at night. And surfers loved that.
They didn't look as if they were covered in blood, though, did they? They're all red stuff.
No, it just drips off. So that was, you know, a borderline what we call harmful algal blooms. But there are other species of algae that can cause devastating, harmful impacts on human society. There are some species that exude chemicals in the water and can kill fish. And whereas wild fish stocks can deal with that somehow. They sense that there is something in the water that irritates their gills and actually swim away. For example, we are aware that whole herring migrations sometimes change their regular paths to avoid such an algal bloom. Now, when an algal bloom like that, a fish-killing algal bloom, enters a major aquaculture area, and that happened in 1996 in Port Lincoln, where they just then established a big tuna aquaculture operation that basically overnight killed $45 million worth of cultured tuna. So we need to understand these phenomena. We need to have monitoring programs in place.
That's in South Australia.
That's in South Australia. Yeah, we need to have monitoring programs in place and come up with all kind of mitigation strategy. Like the first thing, if you are operating a fish farm, and we're running fish farms here in Tasmania, you have at least one person on staff that almost every day takes a water sample, see what's in there. If you see such a harmful algal bloom develop, then you start to be on the alert and you start to think, you know, you watch for concentrations to rise. Then you start, the first thing is stop feeding the fish so that the fish are less active, staying on the bottom in the cages. They're not coming in contact with the algae. When it gets worse, you tow away cages. That happened in Port Lincoln in South Australia. You had an incident like that in Tasmania in 2003. And then if it gets worse, then you really need to do much more drastic things. And I'm working with some Korean scientists where we learned that there are special clays that actually mop up all of these toxic chemicals and at least gives the fish an immediate relief.
These are clays like the soil.
Naturally derived soil kind of.
But you need an awful lot of soil, wouldn't you?
Yeah, but you just sprinkle them on the surface of the water and it gives the fish an immediate relief. So in Korea, they have annually recurrent algal blooms in a major aquaculture area, and they over time learned that this is the only way they can deal with it. Otherwise, you know, they have to move that whole aquaculture to another location.
How much does it cost Tasmania, the harm that's done by not being able to manage these blooms properly?
I started to develop this expertise when I was still in Europe, and in Europe and also North America and Japan, we've known of these phenomena for a long time. And in fact, the very first record of a really harmful algal bloom that potentially could kill people dates back to Captain Vancouver when he landed in what is now called Vancouver in 1793. Some of his crew jumped the ship, ate a meal of blue mussels, and five of those people actually died from a phenomena that we now have coined paralytic shellfish poisons. So these microscopic algae, just like there are berries in the forest that can be toxic, there are mushrooms that are toxic to human beings and we learn not to eat them. So there are particular algal species that produce chemicals that have a completely natural functions for the microscopic algae, but they have toxic impact higher up the food chain. So Captain Vancouver was very intrigued what was going on and tried to communicate with the local native Indian tribes. And these Indian tribes made it clear to him, you stupid Europeans, don't you know that when the water is bioluminescent, you don't eat shellfish? So that was really the very first known algal bloom monitoring program. And over time, Western society has caught up on this knowledge that the native Indians already had. We do it through all kind of fancy technologies. We now use molecular probes to test for different species in the water. If a species is present, that potentially has harmful impact, we start to test all of the seafood products for toxins, and according to the toxin levels in seafood, we close particular fisheries. Now, we had such a problem most recently in November last year in Tasmania. And in fact, we were caught out somewhat. Even so, we had a monitoring program in place. The plankton communities in the east coast of Tasmania, that is a climate change hotspot, so the whole marine ecosystem is changing. This is an organism that's called dinoflatulate, Alexandrium tamarense. We had seen it as early as 1982, but it was always in very low concentration, so we didn't worry about it. And a lot of our monitoring effort had been focused on other areas where we had different species that was causing problems, like the Yuen River, the Antarctic Channel. So that left that whole east coast of Tasmania basically uncovered by any monitoring progress. And suddenly there was an algal bloom there, and unfortunately, it escaped our initial monitoring, so some mussels were exported to Japan, and these people have much better monitoring programs than we have, and they picked up the toxins. Yeah, that is not looking good.
So, no. But I actually heard it cost you about $12 million.
That's correct. So, well, the first thing that happened, that led to a global recall, not just of Tasmanian shellfish, it led to a global recall of all Australian shellfish. That is how international markets respond. We call this the halo effect or the public court system. And then we still are assessing the impact of that incident. Then we had to close in Tasmania, harvest of mussels, oysters, scallops. There was some concern of abalone. They appear to be only very minorly contaminated. But the biggest cost actually was we found that the digestive system of lobsters was contaminated. And that was just before the Christmas season. So there was a lot of discussion, what are we going to do about the lobsters? It would have been possible, for example, still to market the lobsters, but as a tail only, with all of the digestive system removed. But the industry itself, and I can understand where they come from, decided that would devalue their product and they didn't want to go there. So also a lot of lobster fisheries were closed. And that has cost Tasmania at least $12 million.
Going back to what you were saying before about how so many of these algae and other creatures in the ocean absorb carbon dioxide, they have also fairly robust shells, even though they're tiny. What happens when the acidity level of the ocean goes up? Will they be affected and will they therefore not be able to absorb as much CO2 from the atmosphere as before?
Climate change has many different aspects to it. One of them, indeed, we get increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and that actually stimulates photosynthesis. So we do an enormous amount of work where we now growing an enormous amount of different Australian microscopic algal species in all climate change scenarios. And actually, the good news is that most microscopic algae will actually grow better. They do photosynthesis better, so they grow faster and they will keep taking more carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. However, there has been some concern expressed, as you correctly refer to, that some species that produce calcareous shells, like the coccolithophorids, that they could potentially be more vulnerable to corrosion by the seawater becoming more acidic. Indeed, some early experiments that were done on the Northern Hemisphere showed this potential effect. So we have been repeating this work, and it appears that there's an enormous variability, that even within one species of coccolithophorid, there are different genetic strains living in different parts of the world that have different sensitivity. So the only thing that we have been able to demonstrate that an organism like coccolithophorids, they will not ever become extinct. They've been here for so long, they're so successful, they have such genetic diversity, they can deal with it. They've seen it all. So I still can sleep at night.
Breathing deeply and every second breath coming from these creatures.
Correctly.
The deeply breathing Professor Gustav Hallegraaff from the University of Tasmania, where they've just spent the week discussing climate and oceans and warming with CSIRO. And breathing, no doubt. Next week on The Science Show, the PM's Prize for Science and more birds, as it's Bird Week, living ones this time, and very clever too. And on Catalyst, the second part of Marianne de Mazes' extraordinary report on cholesterol, which smashed the ratings on Thursday. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher and Simon Branthwaite. I'm Robin Williams.